30-year-old humanitarian aid group Doctors Without Borders provides medical care in 70 countries. In the past month alone, they've admitted new patients to an emergency feeding program in eastern Chad, worked to stop the spread of post-monsoon ailments in Pakistan, and opened a new hospital ward to treat children in Tajikistan. On today's Your Call, we'll be joined by Sophie Delaney, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders in the U.S. Over 270,000 staffers provide care in some of the most dangerous parts of the globe. So how do they do it? And how have the politics of providing humanitarian aid changed over the years? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. President Barack Obama is due to visit New Jersey to inspect the devastation caused by Hurricane Sandy. Millions of homes across the Northeast are still without power following the huge storm, which killed more than 50 people. Trading has resumed on the New York Stock Exchange, but large areas of the city are still flooded. Paul Adams reports from New Jersey.
The sun is shining again after 3 days of torrential rain and lashing winds, but the impact of the biggest storm to hit the Northeastern United States in decades will be apparent for weeks, possibly months. Up and down the Jersey shore, homes have been battered and in some cases swept away. In Atlantic City, President Obama will see a historic boardwalk shredded into piles of timber and fallen trees littering the streets. Thousands of people are still in shelters, millions without power or phone reception. From crashing waves on distant Lake Michigan to deep snow in the Appalachian Mountains, the effects of Hurricane Sandy have been felt across a vast swathe of this country.
The highest appeals court in France has overturned a ruling that cleared two policemen of involvement in the deaths of two teenagers in an incident that sparked weeks of rioting. The youths were electrocuted in 2005 while hiding from police in an electricity substation. Hugh Schofield reports.
This decision by the French High Court of Appeal has been warmly welcomed by the families of the two dead teenagers, Zied Benna and Bouna Traoré. They've always said that the police who were chasing the boys had a duty to come to their help after they sought refuge in the electricity substation. Instead, they left them to their fate. The police officers said they didn't know the boys were going to hide in the substation, and much in the case has hinged on remarks by one officer, recorded at headquarters, that if they hide there, I don't give them much of a chance. This decision means that the case is now to be reopened, with a possible trial eventually of the police officers for non-assistance of persons in danger.
A boat carrying more than 130 people, mainly Muslim Rohingya refugees, has capsized off the coast of Bangladesh. Rahul Tandon reports.
A Rohingya organization that has spoken to a survivor told the BBC that it sank because it had too many people on board. Refugees began getting onto the small ferry, which was moored in the Bay of Bengal between Burma and Bangladesh, on Sunday evening. It eventually set sail on Monday night, but sank just a few hours later. The Bangladeshi Coast Guard is searching the area for survivors. The Rohingyas, who are Muslims, come from the western part of Burma. Thousands of Rohingyas have fled the area since violence broke out between Muslims and the Buddhist majority in June.
The level of unemployment in the Eurozone has risen to 11.6%, the highest it's ever been. Unemployment is worst in Spain and Greece, two countries at the centre of the European debt crisis, where more than a quarter of the workforce are without a job. World news from the BBC. Syrian opposition activists say a bomb explosion near a Shia Muslim shrine outside Damascus has killed at least seven people. Jim Muir reports.
The official Syrian media said the bomb was hidden in a rubbish bag planted in a busy street near the shrine of Sayyida Zainab. It's an important site for Shiite pilgrimage on the southern edge of Damascus. Some reports from activists said the blast came from a motorbike rigged with explosives. It doesn't seem to have been a huge bomb, but the shrine is a sensitive target, given the currents of sectarian sentiment currently running through the Syrian conflict. Levels of violence are higher than ever, with the regime making liberal use of its monopoly of air power.
Libya's parliament has approved a new cabinet, put forward by the Prime Minister, Ali Zeidane, after weeks of political wrangling, which led to the dismissal of his predecessor. An attempt to secure parliamentary approval on Tuesday was abandoned after protesters twice disrupted the session. Mr. Zeidane said he'd try to ensure that all the main political parties and regions of Libya were included in his government. One report said the security forces fired shots into the air to disperse demonstrators outside today's meeting. The Kenyan Deputy Foreign Minister, Richard Onyonka, says more than 2,000 African Union peacekeepers have died in Somalia since 2007. It's the first time an official number of dead has been given in the war against the Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab. Archaeologists in eastern Bulgaria say they've unearthed the oldest prehistoric town ever found in Europe. The settlement of houses and large stone walls has been dated at more than 6,000 years old. The walls are thought to have been built to protect stores of salt, which was then a hugely valuable commodity used to preserve meat. The discovery also helps to explain a hoard of ancient gold found nearby, as researchers had questioned how a community, poor in natural resources, had acquired such wealth. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The International Medical Humanitarian Organization, Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, was established by doctors and journalists in France back in 1971, and at that time it was a small organization. Today, over 270,000 staffers provide medical help in 70 countries to people in need, regardless of their race, religion, or political affiliation. But working in conflict zones has also impacted their operation. Last year, their offices were raided in Bahrain, and one local staffer was arrested. And then in 2004, five staffers were killed in Afghanistan. With the proliferation of natural disasters and armed conflicts, what are the challenges of working as an aid worker? MSF is an independent organization, and they do not take sides in conflicts. So what are the politics of humanitarian aid today, and how has it changed over the past four decades? Today, we are joined by Sophie Delaney. She's executive director of Doctors Without Borders in the United States. The new book, Humanitarian Negotiations Revealed, The MSF Experience, analyzes how MSF has compromised in the past or negotiated in various ways, often with unsavory armed groups or governments, to gain access to patients. And Sophie joins us in San Francisco. Hi, Sophie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, it's great to have you. You began your tenure in 2009 with Doctors Without Borders. Can you first off talk about how you got involved with this organization?
Actually, I started to get involved in the organization in 1993, and my first assignment was in Thailand as a country administrator. At that time, we were providing assistance to refugees. There were still some Cambodian and Vietnamese camps on the border, and we were developing very large program to fight against malaria for Burmese refugees along the Thai-Burmese border. So this is where I started my first mission with MSF. Then I went to Rwanda, and then I had several assignments in headquarters and in the field, including in China and on a North Korean program. And it's indeed in 2009 that I took this position in the U.S.
And talk a little bit about the history of Doctors Without Borders. I understand that when it was established back in 1971 by doctors and journalists in France, it was so small compared to what it is today.
Oh, yes. It was a group of five doctors. And over the 40 years of our existence, we've actually grown. We'll now have, as you say, 27,000 people as we speak on the ground delivering medical assistance. And the organization clearly has developed along with the rest of the aid system, I must say. Most organizations have followed the same path, which is a sign of the importance of aid in the current society, but also, with, sadly enough, it's a sign that humanitarian crises keep occurring on a regular basis and with even greater magnitude today.
And I read a few of the programs that MSF has been involved with just in the past month. But if you go to your website, I mean, it's really amazing just to look at the wide range of work that you're doing just this month. For example, responding to post-flood needs in Pakistan, dealing with emergency hunger in eastern Chad, dealing with cholera in Haiti,
There are post-monsoon ailments in Pakistan, Kenya's refugee camps, Ethiopia's natural hurdles, so many things, and I didn't even read all of them. How have you been able to expand so quickly and so fast over the past couple of decades?
You know, actually, this has become a great challenge this year, the accumulation of crises that we have to respond to. And I must say that there are some countries where we've been intervening for almost three decades just because they've been facing emergencies over this time. And we've tried over the years to actually narrow down our mandate to really stay focused on medical care, on emergencies, on conflict, on very acute health crisis. But despite that, and despite the fact that we've not engaged in development work, that in education work, although we do a lot of training for our staff, we are still growing as an organization because of the needs themselves are growing, and because there aren't enough aid actors who are able to intervene in these emergency conditions on the ground.
And how do you decide where to turn your attention? Can you give us an example? Do you talk, for example, to NGOs in an area to find out where the greatest need is?
Oh, yes, of course. This is part of all the assessments we made before deciding whether or not to intervene. We usually intervene in places where the health system has collapsed or is not existent, and when there are some needs that require life-saving medical assistance. So these are the criteria for us to intervene. And in these circumstances, what we would do is to look at the existing response. And depending on the gaps, we would decide whether or not we would intervene if there is an added value for us to provide this care.
And
so it does involve talking to all the NGOs, but also the authorities, the communities, and trying to understand where the real needs and gaps are.
And what is it like to deal with governments, specifically governments that are committing atrocities and causing internally displaced populations or a refugee crisis?
Well, as we try to analyze and review in the book, Humanitarian Negotiations Reveal, every single involvement in a country involves a certain degree of negotiation, not just with governments, actually, but with different groups in the collectivity, including the civil society. And these negotiations always involve a certain degree of compromise. So we're aware that in order for us to be able to successfully implement our program, we need to be accepted not just by the authorities, but also for the communities where we are working, so that they really understand why we're here, and they see the value of coming to a health center and seeking help if they need. So it's indeed a difficult thing to negotiate with a government or a party who we know is perpetrating some violence. We are trying to. We've adopted different stances over the years regarding this. At the beginning in the 80s, we were a very human rights organization. We actually protested and denounced totalitarian regimes. In the 90s, we went a bit further in even trying to take part in the political debate by asking for a military intervention. As you know, we asked for a military intervention in Rwanda, and we've learned from this. We realized that it's not necessarily the role of NGOs to do that, and that this kind of call have very serious impact on the population themselves. It can harm the population because it does involve some violence, some collateral damage, and this is certainly not the impact a humanitarian organization want to have. It's quite the opposite. We want to alleviate suffering. So since the 2000, we've adopted a more neutral, impartial stance. We're trying to distance ourselves from the politics, although we acknowledge we are a political actor among in these environments. But we're trying not to take stance and to focus on our medical care, making sure that our impartiality is translated into action by really providing care to all those in need. So this is how we deal with this dilemma.
We're speaking with Sophie Delaney, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders in the U.S. Over 27,000 MSF staffers provide medical help in 70 countries to people in need, regardless of their race, religion, or political affiliation. And if you're a supporter of Doctors Without Borders, we would love to hear from you. What do you value about the important and critical work that they do? And what questions do you have about how their support is used? And if you've been an aid worker, or if you're thinking of working in an international aid organization, what are your thoughts on Doctors Without Borders? What questions do you have about the work they do on the ground? And then there's so many politics involved. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And also, what are your thoughts about their decision not to take sides in these conflicts? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you have specific questions about countries, I'm going to ask about Syria in just a couple of minutes. But again, they are working in so many volatile and dangerous parts of the globe. You can also leave a comment on our website. So why don't we talk about Syria? Because one of the operating nurses, Ruth Priestley, said, quote, "We just kept working day and night." And you established your surgical trauma hospital in Syria in mid-June in collaboration with the Union of Syrian Medical Relief Organizations. And by the end of September, more than 1,100 patients had been treated. And so Ruth has just incredible things to say about what happens on the ground. One man we operated on had at least 20 wounds in his body from bomb blasts. Seven children came in at one time. Can you talk about what it looked like to team up with the Syrian Medical Relief Organization and how you were able to establish a trauma hospital there?
Yes, Syria has been a very challenging place to try to work in, and it was not just a challenge for Doctors Without Borders. There are hundreds of organizations who've been trying to provide assistance since the beginning of the conflict. We are trying constantly to negotiate with the Syrian authorities to have a legal access to the health facilities. So far, we haven't been successful. So in the meantime, not being satisfied with the status quo, we've actually explored ways to work with networks, and so have done other NGOs. So at the beginning of the conflict, we would send some supplies to some medical staff present inside Syria and try to help them establish their own health facilities. We wanted to keep this activity at a small scale because we didn't have enough visibility regarding the impact of our action until we were finally able to identify some more reliable and active networks who could help us get into Syria and establish the facilities that you just mentioned, Rose. So, of course, the collaboration with local communities and local NGOs is absolutely instrumental to our own ability to penetrate the country. In parallel with these operations, this surgical care that we're giving inside Syria, we've also been able to treat hundreds of Syrian patients in our hospital in Amman, Jordan. A few years ago, we established a hospital for the Iraqi victims of bombings, and we did reconstructive surgery there. And this hospital is now very helpful, not just to treat Iraqi people, but also Syrian people that are referred abroad.
And talk a little bit about the safety of the staff. And, for example, have you been in contact with the Syrian government?
Yes, we've been in contact, many contacts with the Syrian government, and although they did not give us the official authorization to work inside Syria, when we were able to establish these underground clinics, we actually informed them about it. We told them where we were, and we asked them to respect the sanctity of this health facility. We're very much concerned about the criminalization of health facilities that is going on in Syria. Syria is not an exception. There's been other countries like Bahrain, you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, where there has been literally crackdowns on health facilities. It's clearly unacceptable for us. It's a breach of all the the rules of war and the humanitarian law. And so we wanted to make clear with the Syrian authorities that we were operating there and we expect them not to target our facilities and to allow us to treat the patients who need it.
Have governments ever imposed restrictions on Doctors Without Borders?
Governments in general, you mean?
Yes, or can you point to a government that has done this?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, every intervention in every country involve negotiations and involve compromise. And by compromise, I mean limitations. So these can be limitations in terms of access to some specific areas. I have two examples in mind, Myanmar being one of them. We've worked in Myanmar for 20 years, but there are areas of the country where we've never been authorized to establish programs, although we knew there were very tremendous medical needs. Pakistan is also a good example where we have been authorized to reach certain areas in the north, in the tribal areas, including in Baluchistan, which is a province very, very difficult to get access to. But there is a province in Pakistan, the Waziristan province, where the government has never accepted that we operate. So access to some territories is a clear limitation. In some countries, we've also been asked in some circumstances not to speak out, not to inform or publish any information about the situation where we work. So we always, for the sake of accountability, we always communicate with our donors and on our website, as you've seen, about the type of medical work that we do, the impact that it has. But in some circumstances, we've had to refrain, express our outrage regarding the violence that we were exposed to in order to be able to continue to treat patients.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you brought that up because I just wondered how are these amazing staffers, the nurses, the doctors, the support staff, how are they able to be, I guess, I don't know if impartial is the right word, but there is a critique of the role humanitarian organizations play in hotspots around the world, that the scenes of suffering are very much linked to political circumstances in those countries, and there's no way to respond to them in an apolitical matter because the work that you do has a huge political impact. So how do you deal with this issue?
Yes, that's true. And, you know, actually, the way... First, most of our medical staff acknowledge that it's not about them, it's about the patients, and that as much as they might be shocked or affected by what they see, still the condition of the patient is worse than theirs. So they're very much, you know, they're very much aware of the situation. This being said, it's true that, and as you raised the testimony of the surgeon and this nurse in Syria, they are extremely shocked by what they see, and we always want to express our outrage. So there are different ways to deal with this. Either the organization is going to decide to speak out in the name of the organization, in which case clearly the aid workers will be the one to provide the testimony. Or if the organization for some reasons decide that it's not a good timing to communicate or that it's not appropriate and it's going to undermine our ability to operate, in that case we still debate the issue internally a lot. We also try to ensure that there is a regular turnover of the staff. We try to avoid the burnout because these are very stressful situations, and we are also providing some psychosocial support to the staff who is returning from these field assignments.
We actually just got a question from Rob who says, do you see many of your staffers with problems similar to PTSD after they get home, and if so, are programs in place to help them? He says MSF is a great organization and he supports your work.
Well, I'm very grateful for his comment. Yes, absolutely. We've seen cases, and this is why we have this in place. In some very exceptional circumstances, we've either evacuated the whole team. I remember when I was in Rwanda after what we called the Kibio incident, by which the Rwandese army literally killed hundreds, thousands of displaced in the camp, and MSF was the only organization present in the camp. We were just the witness of this massacre. We repatriated the whole team and provided some psychological support. In the right after the Haiti earthquake, we already had 300 staff on the ground, but they were deeply affected. They had been also, to some extent, the victim of this earthquake, and some of our staff had even lost some families there. So what we did was we started to treat patients, mostly surgical patients, and we sent a crew of psychologists who took care of our staff first. And once our staff was back on its feet, or when we were able to identify who was able to continue the activity and who was not, and to send the appropriate support, team support, then we also included the mental health component in our program for the patients themselves.
We're speaking with Sophie Delaney, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders in the U.S. Over 27,000 staffers provide medical help in 70 countries to people in need, regardless of race, religion, or political affiliation. And if you have any questions for Sophie about the work they do on the ground, how they decide where to go, how long to stay, what it's like to negotiate with these governments, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And if you support their work, why do you support this kind of work? Why do you think it's so important? And what questions do you have about how the support is used? Sophie, you're a billion-dollar organization today. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true.
So
in terms of operations.
Wow, you have really grown since they were formed back in 1971. Five doctors back then, and today it's 27,000 staffers. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment on our website. Now, in this book that has just been published, Humanitarian Negotiations Revealed, you write about, or staffers write about, compromise in the past or negotiations in various ways that were made. And since you have been around for 40 years, what are some of the major lessons you've learned about the right way to deliver aid in conflict zones?
Well, there are many lessons we've learned, and some of them apply to almost all the circumstances, and others would only apply in some very specific situations. This being said, the lessons we've learned in terms of security, for example, which is, of course, as you guess, a very important challenge that we're facing when you decide as an organization to work in conflict zone. The lessons we've learned has been that first, in terms of security, prevention is absolutely key. So you need to have very clear security protocols in place. You need to be very clear about the staff, about the danger. You need to rely and trust the national staff. They are the one who will guarantee your security the best, because they know the environment and they are very keen in having MSF on the ground. So they will make sure that they are making the proper analysis. So prevention and being aware of what the risks are, and being able to keep an independence of judgment to decide whether or not to stay at any given time, and not being under any kind of donor pressure or political pressure is very important to ensure the security. And another lesson we've learned was that the best way to guarantee that you are actually understood, that you are respected, is to be and accepted by the communities on the ground and by the different parties to the conflict, is not just to claim that you are humanitarian and to claim for this, you know, right of getting the space and being protected. It's really by translating your call into action. If you say you're a medical organization and you are providing impartial care, then you need to be able, through your action, to actually conduct medical work, significant medical work, and not other things. And you need to be able to treat patients on both sides. You cannot say that you are impartial if you're not taking the risk of reaching some populations who might be marginalized groups or even, you know, groups from opponent communities. So these are some of the lessons that, I mean, there are many, many others, but in conflicts, acceptance and the way we manage security is really key.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear from listeners on this. When you're talking about a place like Syria, for example, or Rwanda, what role do you think humanitarian organizations should play? Should they take sides in conflicts like these, or should they stay neutral? I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call, and we'll be back after this. I'm Rose Aguilar, and I invite you to join me for a live election night special on KALW. Starting at 5 p.m., we'll be broadcasting from the Freight and Salvage in Berkeley. Veteran political analyst Larry Bensky will break down results from across the country, and we'll bring the conversation home with Bay Area experts and activists, and you. It all starts at 5 p.m. Tuesday, election night live here on KALW. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we will talk about the legacy of Native American activist Russell Means and the American Indian Movement. We will also mark the opening of the American Indian Film Fest, which kicks off in San Francisco. And then on Friday, we will discuss media coverage of Hurricane Sandy. So if you have any thoughts about what you've seen this week and how the media have covered this, there's an interesting report that looks at their failure to really talk about global warming and climate change. So we'll be discussing that on Friday. Today, we are joined by Sophie Delaney. She's executive director of Doctors Without Borders in the U.S. They started back in 1971 in France with just five doctors. And today, over 27,000 staffers provide medical help in 70 countries, many of the most volatile countries in the world. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about Doctors Without Borders? If you're a supporter, why are you supporting them? What value do you think they bring to the world? And what about the politics involved in all of this and not taking sides? What are your thoughts on that, specifically when we're talking about places like Syria and Bahrain, for example? Do you think humanitarian organizations should take sides in a conflict? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And Sophie, we talked a lot about Syria. I mean, the hot spots are on your website, although we don't hear much about Tajikistan in this country, not really much about Eastern Chad, really not much about Africa, frankly, at all, because there's so much focus on the Middle East. But is there a place you're working in now that we might not be aware of?
Well, certainly, I think that one of our major concerns over the past few months has been the crisis in South Sudan. During the summer, hundreds of thousands of people from Sudan have crossed the border into South Sudan, trying to escape from the bombings and the violence that is going on there. And they've landed in some areas with very limited infrastructure, no infrastructure at all, no options for coping mechanisms, and they've been relying since then on international aid. So Médecins Sans Frontières had identified this arrival of people, and we had warned about the risk of a major disaster, which actually has occurred with the rainy season. When we started to work in some of the camps, the mortality rate was three times above the emergency threshold. So now it's back to an acceptable level, but the situation is extremely precarious. We are not only delivering medical care, but because of the lack of other aid actors and response, we are also providing the distribution of clean water, and we're still not at the other at the satisfactory level there. We're distributing only 9 liters per person per day when the standards are 15 liters. So just to give you an idea of how challenging the situation is, this is an area that is very much isolated. There are absolutely no resources around there. We need to fly everything that is needed to deal with this problem. And yes, you know, Rose, you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, we are now $1 billion organization, which allows us actually to do all this work in all these countries. But just to give you an idea of the magnitude of the crisis, by the end of the year, we've estimated that in South Sudan alone, we would have spent $90 million,
wow,
which is really a heavy burden for the organization. This is a crisis that has been that totally underreported. There are many reasons for that. There were other focus by the media, but this has consequences, and to the point that we did something we rarely do, because we're usually asking for unrestricted funding to our donors, but we launched a special appeal for South Sudan recently because we were really afraid that we would not be able to maintain the same scale and level of activity if the emergency keeps going at this rate.
Well, we have a healthcare provider on the line, so let's hear from Erica in Santa Cruz. Hi, Erica. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I want to thank Doctors Without Borders. I think you're incredible. I support you. And I am a vote for serving everybody who needs it, not just one side or the other of a conflict. And I also have a question because I'm a physician assistant, and I've tried to volunteer with Doctors Without Borders, and they don't accept physician assistants, and I don't know why.
Well, Erica, thanks for your kind words first. And it's true that physician assistant is not the kind of profiles that we're looking for when trying to send some international staff. And the reason is that out of the 27,000 staff that we have on the ground, less than 10% are actually international staff. Mm. We rely mostly on national colleagues. And we have we are able to get a large number of physician assistants among our national staff. Mm. So the reason why we're not seeking international ones is that the ones we need to send from abroad are actually physicians, OT nurses, some very specific profiles that are needed to fulfill the job. So this policy might change depending on the needs, but you know, we're very much a needs-based organization, and these are not the types of profile that we're looking for at the moment.
I'm looking at your page right now for volunteers and people who want to work in the field. And right now, urgently needed anesthesiologists, HIV, mm-hmm, AIDS, and TB specialists, certified midwives, OBGYN, and pharmacists.
Absolutely, Rose. And these changes, it really depends on the situation. So, Erica, I would strongly advise you to stay in touch with us and to get you known, so that we, you know, if we need your profile, then we'll be able to get back to you and see if we can send you somewhere.
And Erica, are you still there?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I just want to say again, thank you for your work. Thank you for this show. It's always a great show, and I support you in any way I can.
Well, thank you so much. And mm-hmm. Erica is a healthcare provider. And if you're a healthcare provider or you work in the NGO field and would like to talk about your experience on the ground and just why this is so crucial right now with so many conflicts around the globe, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Gene, if you have any questions for Sophie about what Doctors Without Borders does in 70 countries, we're talking about 27,000 staffers helping so many people in need, regardless of their race, religion, or political affiliation. That's very important to point out. 866-798-8255. You mentioned the Nationals, Sophie, and I was wondering, what it's like when you go to a country, because you often hear about the tension between people who sort of fly in and impose, you know, their belief system or basically what they think needs to be done versus what the locals think needs to be done. Can you talk about that process?
Sure, absolutely. Well, actually, to be honest with you, I wouldn't call it a tension. I think that it's a very nice mix that we have in the field. And most of the time, the national staff is extremely happy to get the support from international staff to get to learn new things and not to take the full responsibility sometimes for some activity for which they would be under great pressure from their community. So this is a very subtle balance that we need to find between international and national staff. We've also had a policy over the years to really try to bring the national staff to create the space for promoting the national staff, for having them have responsibilities. We have a large number of our national staff who are actually today international staff. That is, you know, a Congolese doctor who started as a national staff, who is now working in Syria, for example, or this kind of experience. This is really in the spirit of the organization. We don't want to rely only on national staff because we are an international organization. We believe in this cross-fertilization. We see some value of having a Chinese nurse operating in Chad, or a Pakistani doctor operating in China. Mm-hmm. We see some value in that, and we want to preserve this international spirit of solidarity.
And we have, let's go to our next caller, Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I really support Doctors Without Borders. I always send them money along with other humanitarian organizations. But I have one criticism, and that is that I am inundated with requests for money. I must get forms from, you know, Doctors Without Borders and PETA and other organizations anywhere between 5 and 10 times a year. And I just think it's absolutely ridiculous. I'm sure it cuts into your income. Why do you have to send so many mailings, especially the people who contribute to you anyways? I mean, one mailing is enough. I'm forever throwing these things out. And, you know, it ratchets up the paper problem and everything else.
Well, Nancy, you raised a very good point, because this is a challenge and a dilemma that we're facing all the time. What is the right balance? And we're testing constantly to try to figure out what is the acceptable level. What I can tell you is that we are using more and more the new technologies, and we've shifted a lot of our donors to internet messaging, which saves money for us and a lot of trees. And the advice I would give you really is, please send us an email, and we completely understand. We tailor the communication depending on our donors' will. So we'll be happy to send you just an appeal at the end of the year, if that's fine with you, if this is the way you want to operate. So if you send me an email, sophie.delaunay@newyork.msf.org, I will make sure that you're not inundated by our mailings.
All right. Well, thank you, Nancy. And I was curious, where do most of your donations come from, and how have you been affected by the economic crisis?
Our donations come from mostly private donors. We have made the conscious decision not to seek funding from some governments who we think are playing an instrumental role in the conflicts where we work, and therefore we don't want to create any perception that we're affiliated with these governments. The U.S. is one of them, but the French is also one of them. And so we rely on, I think the latest figure we got was 4.5 million donors worldwide. And the U.S. Account for the most generous country, I would say, because this is where we get the largest private donations. So this is key to our independence. We've been affected by the economic crisis, as everybody, because our donors also have been affected. What we've experienced in recent months was a decrease in the average gift. So it's interesting to see that we continue to acquire new supporters, and our supporters remain loyal to the organization, but the average gift has decreased, which is very unfortunate for us, because it's not commensurate to the level of activity that we are facing and the number of emergencies.
Right.
So we're facing a hard time like every other organization.
And I'm sure demand is so extremely high. You brought up the United States, and you say that people living here give a lot of money. And I'm just curious, because, I mean, just to be frank, you know, so many of the crises you're dealing with are because of U.S. foreign policy. And I'm wondering, do you have a relationship with the U.S. government? Have you had opportunities to sit down with politicians to talk about the end result of U.S. foreign policy and what really happens on the ground around the world?
Oh, yes. We've addressed these problems on many fronts with the U.S. governments, whether it is about sharing with them on a regular basis the humanitarian impact of the policies on the ground. So we've had numerous conversations about Afghanistan, for example. Mm-hmm. When we wanted to restart our operations there, we've been in touch with the U.S. military. I even had some calls with Admiral Mullen, the chief of staff at that time, to really make them understand that it was key for them to respect the health facilities, not to target them, and to distinguish themselves from humanitarian organizations. So our messages have been heard. We are in constant dialogue with them, not just on the specific geographic, you know, impact or of humanitarian impact of their policies, but also on broader policies like trade policies that would affect the ability of countries to produce generic drugs, the funding policy of the PEPFAR of the U.S. government regarding HIV, for example, and how it does have an impact in the countries where we work when the countries lose their grants and their funding for HIV, for which they have established a specific national program, and then the patients show up at our door, basically. Mm-hmm. when a national program is stopped. So we have clearly this dialogue, and we have very I must say that we always keep a healthy distance from governments, but we have a very fruitful dialogue with most of them.
And are they receptive to hearing what's really happening on the ground? Because the fact is, we don't really see it. Right, we might hear about a bombing, but even that, I haven't really seen that much in the headlines.
No, they are receptive, but they also have their own interests, their own objectives, and it's clear that we don't share the same objective. The U.S. has a security and political agenda, and MSF doesn't. MSF has a humanitarian agenda. And so sometimes our objectives are just conflicting.
We're speaking with Sophie Delaney, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders in the U.S. 27,000 staffers provide medical help in 70 countries. And we've got just about 10 minutes left. So if you'd like to get in a question or a comment for Sophie about the work they do around the world, what are your thoughts about staying neutral in places like Syria or somewhere like Rwanda, for example, in the past? And if you are a healthcare provider, if you work in international aid, we'd love to hear from you to talk about the importance of this kind of work. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And Sophie, when you mentioned that spending $90 million on Sudan and how that took just a huge chunk out of your money and the funding that you have, I can't help but think about how much is spent on the occupations, for example, right? Billions of dollars every week.
I'm sorry, Rose, but I missed your question.
Well, I was just thinking about what you're able to do with $1 billion, for example, and how much is spent on conflicts and occupations and invading other countries, right? Tens of billions every week. It's just amazing to kind of look at the comparisons there.
Yes, actually, about 40% of our activity is triggered by conflict, and it's quite it's quite illustrated in our budget. 40% of our budget is spent in treating victims of conflict and in operating in unstable areas. And the rest is dedicated to health crises like HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and dealing with some neglected disease.
Well, let's go to our next caller, Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just have two questions. I support them in the first place through my phone company, and I always list Doctors Without Borders first for donations, but it certainly isn't very much, but I would do more if I could. I just want to know, how do you get specialists, doctors, medical specialists, when you need them for a patient in a country where wounds are so different during conflict? And then the other question was, how do you find translators to work with the doctors who are doing the operations and care? So that's all I had. I do hope I had more money, but that's how it goes.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you, Nancy. Every dollar counts. So thank you very much for your support. And your question is a very good one, because it's actually a challenge for us, of course, because you wonder how we could anticipate the specific needs that we might have in terms of a medical specialty. As a matter of fact, we've accumulated, you know, a large experience in operating in this kind of areas and conflicts. So we know the kind of skills that are necessary. We also know what the resources we have, the medical resources. We've established some protocols. We have our medical kits ready. We've established some surgical kits, you know, some malaria kits, some vaccination kits that include everything from the pen to the most updated medicine to deal with this issue. So we have groups of doctors and who are working on a daily basis at headquarter level or in the field to set up the medical framework of these interventions. And so we are able to anticipate. We know that when we prepare for our action plan at the beginning of the year, there is about 70% actually of our portfolio that is already in place. You know, as I said, we've been working in South Sudan, we've been working in the DRC in Somalia for many, many years, and we know that the country is not going to stop this year. So we know that we have programs in place that we're going to continue. We might have to adapt them, but we can easily predict what are the kind of resources we will need and skills that we will need to run them. And then there is about 20% of our programs that are unallocated, as we say, because we want to keep an ability to respond to emergencies. But we also know that in these kind of emergencies, we know what we're going to do. We're going to do war surgery, we're going to do vaccination, we're going to do obstetric care, and we're going to do the delivery of non-food items or treatment of clean water. So it's kind of easy to anticipate what are the skills that we're going to need. And we are in a constant recruiting mode in the organization. We receive applications all the time. We process all of them. And once we found application that we think fit the organization, we conduct some interviews. So once the person is considered as a good resource for MSF, this person is placed in a sort of virtual pool. We organize trainings on a regular basis. And as soon as we need this person, and depending on his or her availability, we send them on the ground. So this is for I hope I responded to your first question, Nancy. As for the translators, we are recruiting them most of the time on the ground. It's of course a challenge, because we're not the only international organization operating. So other NGOs also need translators. What we also do is trying to recruit in the areas as well. We have lots of international staff who are actually from Western African countries. For example, we've started some recruitment in the Middle East last year because we wanted to have more Arabic speaker in our crew. So this is how we try to deal with this challenge. But just to say also that it's less of a challenge than the international staff, because as long as the translators are recruited nationally, they stay in the program and they will serve, they will do the translation for all the different medical staff that is taking over the program.
We have another question about staffers in conflict zones. So let's hear from Roberta in Richmond. Hi, Roberta.
Hi. Hello. My question was whether you have a rotation schedule. And I do have a comment if there's time. So.
Okay. Is there a rotation schedule?
Yeah, that's what I meant by the turnover. We have a rotation schedule. That is, we try to, we ask our international staff to commit to stay at least 9 months in the field. We make an exception for surgeons because we know we wouldn't be able to have any surgeons if we had these drastic measures, and because they usually can't get out of their work more than a month. Usually they even take on their own vacation to go and work with us. So this is the rotation. The rotation has side effects. You know, it's difficult to capitalize knowledge in the organization. It forces us to have a complete different way of sharing, of standardizing practices, of sharing knowledge. On the other hand, it's absolutely key to keep fresh blood in the organization. It brings a lot of innovation. And at the same time, it's also impossible to stand the stress and the burden of this work on the longer term. So after 9 months, all of us are very happy to go back to civilization, I must say.
And Roberta, another question. We're almost out of time.
Okay. It's a comment that I used to agree with Nancy and say, oh, God, I just sent them a check. And then I realized that the feeling I had from that was like, okay, I've helped. And then I realized, I don't mean to sound like a dick, as the guy next door would say, but it hasn't. I mean, it's a little bit. It's happening all over. There's more and more. So it makes you think, all right, can I do another $20? Can I do this? But there is a different way of looking at it. And in terms of treating the other side, I definitely support that. It's, we're all part of the whole. So thank you for your wonderful work, and it is courageous.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Roberta. And Sophie, we just have about a minute left. Final thoughts from you, and what are future plans for Doctors Without Borders?
Well, unfortunately, we know for sure that humanitarian crisis will not stop anytime soon. So we have the plan of trying our best to respond to the most acute emergencies. Of course, we'll have to make some choices, some priorities. There are some areas of concerns to us at the moment, and tuberculosis, and particularly drug-resistant tuberculosis, is one of them. We realize that it's getting a very heavy burden in our medical programs, that the drugs that we are using to treat drug-resistant tuberculosis are not effective. We managed to treat only 50% of our patients so far, so it's a major concern. There are, I mean, the pipeline is quite promising. There are dozens of drugs that are in process that have been developed, but they won't be available anytime soon, or at least available to our patients before the next 5-6 years. Mm. So this is, I think this is going to be the priority of next year, to try to challenge this paradigm.
Sophie Delaney is Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders in the U.S., working in 70 countries. Sophie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose, for inviting me.
Thank you. And thank you for your emails and phone calls. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What is the legacy of Russell Means and the American Indian Movement? On the next Jura Call, we will honor the passing of Native activist Russell Means and mark the opening of the American Indian Film Festival in San Francisco. Russell Means was a fearless leader of the American Indian Movement in the 60s and 70s and led several actions, including the occupation of Alcatraz. So how does his legacy affect Native activism today? It's Jura Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Jura Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.